This is XTP Media.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson from XTP Media and welcome to episode 29 of Extended, coming to you live from the Farnborough International Air Show 2014. And I'm here with Tim Robinson, Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine.
Hello everybody.
And we're also joined today by our very special guest for this live Farnborough show, by Jean-Vincent Raymondin, Social Media Manager for the Airbus Group.
Hello everyone, happy to be there.
And this episode is being brought to you with the kind support of the Airbus Group. In this episode, we talk Farnborough news on day three, this being Wednesday during the trade week. We've been out and about seeing various aircraft and organisations, and we also have a Farnborough Pods Challenge. We're on the road again this week, and we'll be shelving a few of the sections, but we'll catch up with the listener mails when we get back into the studio. But, as always, let's get started by looking at what's caught our eye at Farnborough so far. Okay, Tim, Jean-Vincent, what do you think are the key items? And let's get the F-35 out of the way.
Yeah, I mean, this was the big cliffhanger for the Farnborough show. F-35, was it going to appear? Wasn't it going to appear? You know, unfortunately, there was an engine fire incident just before the show. The LM team and test pilots engineers were working to solve the issue. It didn't make the air to two. Disappointed a lot of people, and right up until yesterday, they were still hopeful that they could make the end of the show. Yeah. Unfortunately, the Pentagon, although they lifted the grounding of the fleet, said that the engine's still not resolved. He's going to have 3 hours between checks on the engine, so it's not coming to Farnborough. So, you know, a bit disappointing. You know, obviously a lot of work gone into it, but in the end it's a sort of sensible decision.
Yeah, and if you're coming to see the show this weekend, there is an F-35 here, but it's just a mock-up.
That's right, yes.
And it has already been pointed out to me that there are a lot of differences on that mock-up than the real aircraft, so don't expect too much on that. So, unfortunately, the F-35 is not here, along with Gareth, who also couldn't make it, so apologies from Gareth. But it's been a busy show. It doesn't look very busy, but a lot of business has been done. We're sitting in the Airbus chalet, and of course, the great news this week was the launch of the A330neo.
Okay, yeah, that's the one of the big civil, a new civil airliner from Airbus. It's a refreshed and updated sort of version of their wide body, the A330. It's got new Trent 7000 engines. It's going to be 14% more fuel efficient than the old 330. Customers are sort of desperate for it. They've already racked up some orders here. Lesser's going for it, AirAsia X. Looks to be very popular, and they're going to get into service pretty quickly. You know, they're talking about 2018, which is really, really fast for an airliner.
Yeah, and you know, we're sitting here in the Airbus chalet. I've got to say, it's a very, very impressive Airbus display. All the aircraft here, it's very powerful. Airbus really are here.
Well, we are here definitely. I mean, we are here with the pavilion since 2 years. I mean, we were there at the previous edition 2 years ago. On the static display, I mean, for the very first time, we are bringing the E-Fan, which is the whole electrical aircraft.
Yeah.
We're also bringing the A350 for the first time in the UK at an air show.
Yeah.
And we are really happy about that.
Yeah. I've had the opportunity to go through the A350. I've got to say, it's probably the best looking aircraft that Airbus have produced, I think. It looks good, so for all of our aviation fans out there, it's a pretty aircraft, but the technology is absolutely phenomenal.
That's correct. I mean, it's an aircraft full of new technologies and innovation, but it's also made of composite.
Yeah.
Over than 50% of the aircraft is made of composite, yeah, which is it's a first, yeah, in aviation.
Yeah. And we're going to see the aircraft fly today. Tim, you've had the opportunity to fly in the aircraft.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. It's quiet on the inside. It's very quiet on the outside. It's impressive. It's very impressive.
Yeah. So let's move on to look at some other things. New radar for the Typhoon, Tim.
Yeah, that was a sort of a world premiere yesterday. EASA radars for Typhoon, it's always been a feature. It's lacked. Other fighters have got it, Rafale and some of the American fighters. So it's been something that's been missing. They've just revealed yesterday that they've got a new Captor E radar that's going to start testing on the Typhoon, and a lot of work got into it, and now we've got an EASA radar there ready to equip the Eurofighter as an upgrade and really a sort of a world beating capability with this. So very, very makes the aircraft even more potent. There's still things to be sorted out. The nations still have to agree and sort of say, we're going to actually buy this this new radar. But it's a real boost for its export potential.
Yeah, and we've talked Airbus, Boeing are here of course as well. There is an American contingent that's here, both on the civil and the military side. What about some of the other players? We've seen Phil Mechanica over the other side, got big display there, lots of aircraft. What's the news out there?
Augusta Westland has been doing pretty well in terms of deals. There's other some of the new entrants as well. Embraer has been doing well on the civil airliner side, E2. Funny enough, Bombardier, even though their C-Series isn't here, like the F-35, that's had a bit of an engine issue. They've been doing all right.
The Q400's got some good orders, hasn't it?
We're doing deals as well. And a couple of interesting orders as well, or LOIs for Mitsubishi's MRJ.
Yeah. Right, okay. Didn't pick that one up. Also, a lot of engine orders as well. Rolls, of course, we've talked about the A350 and the A330 and the new engine there. There seem to be some really good engine orders coming through.
Yeah, I mean, there was a big Indian leasing order the other day, which was quite a big one for an Indian leasing order for the I think it was the A320neo.
I can't
recall off the top of my head. It's now Wednesday. How many it was, but it was pretty big.
Yeah.
The other interesting story from the show is the battle of the MPAs. UK defence capability. Yep. We got rid of Nimrod. Next year, perhaps we're going to start thinking about revisiting that. So we've got all the manufacturers here with their offerings. Boeing has brought the P-8 Poseidon. That's been flying in the display. Airbus Defence and Space has got the C-295 from Portugal. We've also got Saab MSA, and there's also L3 promoting their Q400. So it's going to be an interesting battle, next year.
Do you think for the UK the P8 is a viable product?
I mean, it's got a lot of following. People are impressed with it. The big question with the P8 is, how many can we afford?
Yeah.
And Hammond, the outgoing defence secretary, warned the week before the show. He said, don't think of the MPA as an aircraft. Think of it as a capability.
Yeah.
So that indicates it might be a mix. So it might be a mix of aircraft and UAVs, perhaps, or even high end aircraft, lower end aircraft. It's it's a little bit open at this moment.
Yeah. I haven't seen much news on the rotary side. Has there been any interesting developments on the helicopters? Not seen much. Seems to be a bit quiet.
I think there's been a lot of low-level deals being talked about.
Yeah.
Obviously, they don't grab the attention as much as 50 A330 Neos but people are there. I think there's been some updates on Bell and their Relentless 525. There's stuff going on.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, it's not all out outside as well. Some of the hall's got some very interesting products in there. Some great representation from British industry in the halls, particularly in the aerospace side. Very impressed with the with what's being shown there. Reaction engines are here. We've had a chat with Parajet as well, and they're going to display, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what that is. Good sort of mentioning reaction engines, because I think that's another big news story from the show is UK spaceport.
Yeah.
You know, are we going to have like a Dandare spaceport in the future? Government announced on Tuesday that they'd narrowed a few down. I think there's eight sites being talked about. Six of them are in Scotland, though.
Yeah.
Which, given there's like a referendum in September, you know, somebody's obviously assuming that Scotland will still be part of the UK come October. But again, they're talking about 2018, they can get this thing up and running and have a UK spaceport, you know, perhaps to launch space tourism or low-cost satellites.
Yeah, and the Prime Minister was here, I think, on Monday, wasn't he? And I think there was an announcement of an additional £2 billion worth of investment in the British aerospace sector, looking to invest to grow it. It's fantastic news.
Well, that was on the defence side of things, yeah. So that's a boost to ISR. UAVs, and also it's extended the Sentinel and the Shadow. They were supposed to go out of service in 2014. After Afghanistan wound down. It's now been extended to 2018.
Yeah.
So the Sentinel has been saved from the axe.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good news. Talking about UAVs then, any good stuff on Taranis or anything like that?
There was an update on Taranis, obviously a very secretive project. People don't like to talk about it. It's still testing an undisclosed location, somewhere sort of hot and deserty. And they'd said they'd done some second phase of trials, and they'd demonstrated it in its full-up stealth capability.
Yeah.
So with all the antennas replaced by low observable features, their data center probe removed. And that had gone well, so you know, making it virtually invisible to radar and also infrared.
Right. Okay. Okay, then, gentlemen. I haven't seen the air display yet, but you, I think you both you two have. What's the to look for item in the air display today?
Well, again, we have the EFAN here flying for the very first time in the UK. You will be quite surprised by its noise.
Okay.
It's really
lack of noise.
Exactly. That's right. Probably the most silent aircraft you will see ever.
Yeah.
Well, and then what's really impressed me is our aircraft. There's one on the runway already and one flying, and they follow each other, which one is about to land, the other one is taking off right away.
Yeah.
That's quite impressive.
Yeah. And what are we going to see from Airbus displayed today? Apart from the EFAN, is the A350 and the A380?
So today we'll start with the EFAN, followed by the A380, the A350, and then ending with the A400M.
Oh yes, I forgot the A400M. Looking forward to that one. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and after that we're going to come back and talk to Jean Vincent.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome from the Royal Aeronautical Society. The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Okay, we're back live at Farnborough with the very kind support of the Airbus Group. Tim.
Okay, so we've got a guest here, Jean Vincent, who is Avgeek extraordinaire at Airbus Group. He's got a really cool job. JV, as you're known online, can you explain your social media job role at Airbus Group? What is it you actually do?
Well, thank you, Tim, for the introduction. That's a really nice one. I'm the social media manager of Airbus Group, which means, of course, I'm responsible for the platform management, but also for the strategy overhaul social media. I have, of course, counterparts within our division, so I'm working very closely with people at Airbus, Airbus Defence and Space, and, of course, Airbus Helicopters. We are trying to set up our presence online and especially on social media, because this is simply, I mean, the new tools that everyone is using and where everyone is.
And how did you get such a cool position? You know, it's a pretty recent idea for a big aerospace company to have social media experts on hand.
Well, I started to work for Airbus Group around five years ago, in Munich, where I was in the branding department. I worked on the first rebranding of the group, formerly known as EADS. Later on, I joined the online department, and we initiated our activities on social media. And that's correct. I mean, most of the big aerospace companies are now present on social media. And having social media experts within our industry is something that I would say is recent. That's correct. But again, today you can't really avoid those tools. We have to be there. If not, someone is going to take over your voice, which was actually the case before we initiated all those activities. I mean, the name EADS was already taken by someone. Luckily, he was a fan of the group, so he handed over the account to us really nicely, and that was pretty nice having the account back and starting over everything.
Okay, you're obviously a really passionate AV geek and aviation enthusiast. So what sparked off your interest in aviation in the first place?
Well, my father was a pilot for Air France, flying on an Airbus A340 at that time.
Okay.
So since I'm young, I was flying with him. So we traveled the world all around. I knew cockpit from the beginning. And I mean, I never left. And now, when he's coming, especially to Le Bourget, I am the one taking him on board, and I am the one giving him tour on aircraft. So I'm pretty proud about that.
Does he still fly?
Yeah, he's flying his own aircraft, the Socata TB20.
Right. Okay.
But I mean, it's a much smaller aircraft.
Okay. Obviously, Airbus Group has a massive range of products. You've got airliners, helicopters, fighters, even rockets. What's your favorite aircraft or spaceship from this lineup?
Well, I mean, we are here on the terrace of the Airbus Group Chalet, and the only one we can see from here, clearly, is the A380. This is definitely one of my favorite. I flew it a few times, and I must say, of course, the noise inside is, I mean, it's really silent. Of course, comfort, that's something Airbus is really into at the moment. But, I mean, we have also space activities, which we should not forget. We are launching the last ATV by the end of July.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we are doing the link between the ISS or whatever the planet would be.
Yeah.
If you think about this Mars rover actually on the red planet, on Mars, this is something really, really cool. I mean, he's alone up there.
And what's the challenge of, I suppose, promoting something like space before it was very much an aircraft-only business, but now you're such a diverse business. Does that put new challenges on you?
Well, not really. I mean, online there's already a huge space community. There are a lot of space lovers.
Yep.
I mean, they know probably more than I do. But again, it's not a huge challenge. I really like those kind of things. I mean, rockets, so Ariane 5, Ariane 6 is coming fairly soon. This is something that is not, it's not a challenge, to be honest.
You're running social media campaigns. What tips would you give somebody to get a social media campaign going? You know, what makes a good picture or a video or a meme go viral?
Well, here at the show, we have a special account who's doing the live coverage of the show. So an aircraft landing, taking off, or doing a barrel roll, we have some guys here next to the runway, so they are able to send pictures HD directly to us. So this is something I'm really pushing on, which is the speed.
Yeah.
We are also, of course, have an eye on crisis. This is something we are really looking at, and always, I mean, we are monitoring 24/7 and are ready in any case. If anything is happening, we'll be there.
And how do you measure the success of an aerospace social media campaign, you know, of likes? And obviously shares is one thing, but, you know, does it actually lead to you know, kind of, you know, airline placing orders, do you reckon?
Well, I don't think so. You don't buy an aircraft using Facebook, not yet. Well, of course, we measure the success with the usual stuff, which is KPIs and reach and those kind of things. The best thing for me is getting feedback straight from there. I mean, you see me there, I'm wearing a special polo shirt thing where it's written in the back, follow me, etc., those kind of stuff. And from time to time, people are just grabbing us.
Yeah.
They take us like that and telling us, hey, are you the guys doing this Airbus Group live thing? And we're like, yeah. And those guys, I mean, are the best ones.
Yeah.
Straight from the side, on the spot, that's the best thing that could ever happen. Of course, online, we're also getting a lot of mentions and people are talking to us. We are trying to get dialogue with them. I mean, again, we are living today on an online world.
Yeah.
Funny enough, I rather prefer meet people physically.
You're pretty active on Twitter. So what about kind of Facebook, Instagram, Vine, you know, LinkedIn as well? Do companies prefer certain media channels for certain messages?
So it's true that we have different channels and are working on a different, I mean, axis and strategy on each of them. Of course, so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and LinkedIn are the main ones where we are. But even on dedicated platform, we divided the audiences. So for example, Facebook, we have two pages, one for the corporate and one for careers. When it goes to Twitter, we have three accounts, one for the press, media relations, one for corporate, and the one again for the live coverage as air shows, events.
It's pretty good coverage as well, you know. I'm not just saying that because I'm here. It's a pretty good feed. I really enjoy it. It's always good. It always feels quite personal. It doesn't feel like big organization. It feels quite intimate.
Well, that's also what we try to do. We have, of course, the corporate account, which is going to remain corporate.
Yeah.
But we have the live account, which is more directed to these geek communities. We have, I mean, you see me, I'm one of them.
Yeah.
And all the guys working with us are the same ones.
Yeah.
Tell us about the two recent campaigns you've done. You know, you had powering up the eFan battery to make it fly and also book your flight. How did those come about?
So in April, we had seen the first public flight of the eFan, the all-electric aircraft. And especially for this flight, we have launched a special campaign, which is called, as a hashtag, We Make It Fly. The idea was there to call any followers, anyone in the world, to virtually recharge batteries of the eFan. Once the battery is charged, it was releasing content, exclusive content. It was an infographic or a video. And the last battery on the D-Day of the event, where we were introducing really the aircraft, we were releasing a live wall where people actually at the event were able to share with us their own pictures. And currently we have launched, right before the show, our second We Make It Fly campaign, where here we are offering a chance to anyone to book a flight, a virtual flight. Sorry for that. virtual flight on a 360 video. So they had the choice to select between the A350, EC135 and the eFan.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen the videos and I know what it's going to look like. It's really impressive. And so the flights are all booked. So it's over 800 flights booked in 3 days. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And when the people will be logged on and fly, they will see that there is some add-ons. There are some add-ons and you can take selfies and these kind of things. This is probably one of the first in this industry. I mean, nobody has ever made such things.
Yeah.
Cool, right. I mean, social media is very fun. It's informative. It connects people. But there's also can be pretty dangerous for kind of corporate or companies or institutions. Have you ever had a social media faux pas or were just about to press publish and just saved it in the nick of time? You can tell us.
Well, I would, but this never happened, really. Lucky. Lucky I am. There could be, of course, typos and mistakes. I mean, I'm French. We have a Spanish guy working within the team. There's, of course, native English. But this can happen.
Yeah.
And we would have to admit it. I'm coming back to the point where we were talking about crisis communication. This is, again, something we are taking very seriously.
Yeah.
We have dedicated agencies that are monitoring everything online 24/7 for us. We have, of course, a working group in case there's anything happening. But again, Tim, this never happened to us. The only thing that was really, I mean, where I've been stressed was when they announced that in Berlin Air Show 3 years ago, the potential merger with EADS and DAE. I was on the runway, next to the runway, and I got a call from my boss saying, you have to come back right now. And I was just like, just tell me what. No, I can't tell you. And there was one aircraft flying, which was the Messerschmitt, so I could not miss it. And it was, I don't care, you come now. So I had to. But, I mean, it's, yeah, it's the way it is. I mean, it's social media. You have to be reactive.
And that's a 24-hour job, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It is. But that's also a passion.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
You mentioned the Berlin Air Show there. You obviously get to a lot of air shows. We see your pics on online. Very, very jealous. So what's your favourite one?
So, yeah, that's correct. I mean, I attend most of the air shows here in Europe and also in Asia. So we attended, of course, the Dubai Air Show, the Singapore Air Show, Paris, but also smaller ones. We are just coming back from Fairfield, from the Air Tattoo. And I've been to La Ferté-Alais. I don't know if you two guys know it. It's one of the most attending air show, at least for Europe, where you have over than 100 old aircraft. Only old aircraft are attending there. It's my favorite.
And going out and meeting people, how many of your followers have you met in real life?
Well, we've met a few. I would say even a lot. You're one of them, Tim. And then now Peter is one of them too. But we are not really counting them, to be honest. We are trying to meet followers everywhere we are. Even if someone is giving us a mention on the Twitter account, I'm going to go straight up to the stand and just meet them up. I mean, that's the way it has to be. We can't, of course, meet everyone. But sometimes we have a quite busy schedule. But we do our best to do that. It's quite important.
So, I mean, this is obviously a really important communications, marketing tool going forward for aerospace companies, that it's more and more important to be online, to have a social media presence and connect with people. What advice would you give to someone on you know, who's on Twitter and wants to get a cool job like yours?
So, of course, I mean, if you have your own personal account, be active. Don't be there just as a watcher, but be professional. You can tweet things that you like, your passion or what you're really looking at or your interest, but don't tweet your everyday life. Sorry to say that, but you see many things online that are not so interested. Use the right content, of course, and the right hashtags. That's something that is getting really powerful at the moment. You can see hashtags everywhere, more or less. I mean, on websites now, you can see hashtags, of course, on Twitter. Facebook has introduced hashtags by last year, I think. So this is getting more and more into those kind of things, keywords.
Okay. Excellent. Well, so, you know, thanks so much for joining us and for being our special guest, and also for putting us up in the chalet. Stick around. We've got Pod's Challenge coming your way.
Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this. Okay, we're back live at Farnborough International Air Show 2014, kindly supported by the Airbus Group. We're out and about, we've done a lot of talking, but we've got from all sectors of the air show a little bit of content, so we'll play you some of what we've been getting right now. Our first segment comes from my tour around the Airbus A350 test aircraft. So we're just going up the steps into the aircraft now, and hopefully Crawford will then take us through the rest of the demonstration.
So this is a flight test aircraft. Everything that is orange is flight test, okay? And that's why it does not look like a normal airliner. What you'll have here when Qatar are flying the aircraft is luxury. What we have here on this aircraft is a lot of science, a lot of engineering, because that's what this aircraft is. It's actually a working aircraft, okay? Now, what you can see from here is, first of all, we have a very wide cabin. We have a very long, straight-walled cabin. And we have very big windows. And that will allow, in an economy class configuration, for 9 abreast seats at 18 inches. So we've got a very, very big and spacious aircraft here that, remember, for Qatar, this is their view on the world, what their passengers see, what their customers see. That is Qatar's face in the world. So we have to provide the best canvas properly that we can for airlines to be able to create the wonderful interiors that then give them, their passengers, and ensure that they come back again and again and again. So this is a new type of flight test equipment. It's all very modular. We can change the boxes. We measure thousands of parameters in every flight. We then data crunch, we then download the data and data crunch it all in Toulouse. And this is what a flight test program is all about. A flight test program is all about finding out how the air, we've got our, how we think it's going to behave. Does it really behave like that? And we have to verify everything to make sure it does behave like that so we can certificate the aircraft. If it doesn't quite, we then have to work out a fix. And that's what a flight, it's a flight test program. We're testing the aeroplane. We're pushing the envelope each time a little bit further to make sure that whilst the aircraft is right in the middle of that envelope in normal flight, we have an utterly safe aircraft. While it's at the edge of that envelope, we know exactly what it's going to do and we have an utterly safe aircraft. And that's one of our all guiding principles for any aircraft designer and any airliner is safety, safety, safety. So, first thing you're going to see is lots of these. These kind of demijohns take about 350 litres of a water glycol mix. I'll just add, they are not used to transport wine around in this aircraft, okay? It's been asked, just in case. And what's it to do? Well, what it does is we can fill them up in various ways to alter the centre of gravity of the aircraft, and then we can understand how the aircraft behaves in that particular flight regime. And we do this again and again and again and again. Now, I'll take you here to the flight engineer station. So if you've seen the video on YouTube, you'll have seen them sometimes in helmets and parachutes here. Other times it's just shirt sleeves, depending on the flight. The top screens are essentially what is on the flight deck. It's what the pilots see. The lower screens are where the engineers are looking at the data they need to collect, and they can also start to specify what screens they can see on the flight deck, just to check and check and check again to make sure that everything is working properly.
And this station's manned on every flight, is it?
It's manned in every test flight. Indeed, during the display flight, there'll be one engineer here.
Right,
there'll be another one up in the flight deck, and there'll be two pilots.
Right, okay.
And the flight engineers are these flight test engineers are very, very skilled people.
Yeah. What's traditionally their sort of background?
They come from an engineering background. We've also, I happen to know one who's an ex-tornado navigator.
Right.
There's various backgrounds, but generally you have to have an engineering aeronautics background.
Okay.
And it's one that they go in lots of courses and have to pass lots of exams as well. So
yeah.
It's something, they're very, very valuable people to our organisation. As are our flight test pilots. I can't leave them out either.
And so on a normal test flight, how many people will be on board?
Typically, I think we're looking at around about 5 to 6.
Right, okay.
It just depends on what particular bit of the flight regime is being examined. If it's one of the bits where it could be deemed to be more hazardous when they're really out on the edge there, then there'll be fewer people. And also, you'll, as you see in the video, some of them have helmets and parachutes. Other times, they're just in shirt sleeves.
Yeah, okay.
So we'll go up the aircraft.
When are you going to end the test programme, and when will the first Rivian flight take place?
Well, we plan to deliver two aircraft by the end of the year to Qatar. So the flight test programme, we're getting very close to finishing the flight test programme. And then the aircraft, all the paperwork will go to get certificated, and actually the paperwork goes on an ongoing basis. It'll be certificated both FAA and EASA, which are the two base certifications for either of the two big manufacturers, and indeed the other manufacturers as well. And then MSN6 will be delivered to Qatar. Qatar are actually taking delivery of all the aircraft, I think, up to MSN14. Pardon?
What happens to this?
Well, some of the flight test aircraft will stay with us. Others, we could be sold on. I know, for instance, in 330, some of the aircraft were sold on. 340 was the same thing. So it's something we'll probably do. We usually keep one or two, like with the 380. We still have the first ever 340 that ever flew. Mm-hmm. We still have the first ever 320 that ever flew.
Right.
And it's somewhat old now.
Yeah.
And flight test aircraft, by their nature, as they get older, they get more things stuck onto them. They end up covered in speak tape and all sorts of things, because that's what we're doing. We're testing and testing and testing. And the other thing we do is we test a new concept. So, for instance, we've introduced a thing called ROPS, which is a runway overrun protection system, which is standard on this aircraft. It's going out through all the rest of our fleet. And that will be something that will enhance safety. That's been tested in the 380. We're supplied in this, and we're applied in the rest of the family.
What is it?
Runway overrun protection system. System to stop aircraft actually going off the end of the runway, maybe land where they run out of space. There's been a lack of.
So it's an automated system that will.
It will advise. It's an advisory system that tell the pilots it's time to make the decision and do a go around. Which is happens in all sorts of operation, even on a day-to-day basis. Again, that's one of our things. It enhances safety a little bit. It does a lot there. So, seating, 9 abreast. These are not the seats that will be in Qatar Airways. Can I just emphasise that? There's no IFE. They're not good enough at all. Who they are good enough for are our flight test engineers and the ground team that look after this aeroplane. What you will notice, though, is they're 9 abreast. They're 18 inches, which is the Airbus standard seat width on any of the aircraft. So you go into 320, it'll be exactly the same. It'll be at 18 inches. And that's something we believe we have a real advantage on, because we have, as standard, a wider seat than our competition. So we'll continue down. To be honest, these ones are probably more representative of what the seats would be like. So, a bit of the aircraft you don't get to see very often. This is the rear pressure bulkhead. This is the very end of the passenger cabin. Normally, this is all covered in galley. And in this aircraft, it'll be the same. But what is great about this one is, you look at it, it's very straight and only starts to really taper about 3 frames from the rear there. So we have a very, very spacious galley. That's something that cabin crew like. Cabin crew like a bit of space to prepare the meals, particularly when you're going to be preparing from all the people in the economy. But we don't escape from a flight test. This here, this is actually a device that we roll out from the top of the tail. So it actually goes through there, and it's a cone, and the cone measures, goes out past where the aircraft's airflow is and measures the air pressure. And that means we can then get a very, very accurate representation of what the speed of the aircraft is during flight test. And this is something, it's actually new equipment in this aircraft, because we actually use, I believe we use Bluetooth or Wi-Fi to monitor it, rather than traditionally it would be lots of cables and things. We're moved on in the 350 in the way we flight test aircraft. Now this aircraft, and bulkhead for instance, A lot of it is made out of carbon fibre. But we very much look the way we use carbon fibre and metallic materials is the right material in the right place. So Airbus has always had an evolutionary nature of using composite materials and advanced materials gradually more and more. So the 380 is around about 25%. This aircraft is about 52% carbon. It's a very good material because in terms of fatigue, it's excellent, but also it doesn't corrode. We also use titanium in this aircraft for exactly the same thing. But again, picking the right material for the right place and apply it in the right place, because we like to keep things simple. We do not believe in any way, shape or form in technology for technology's sake. So for instance, this is a nice bit of simple technology. This is a simple window blind, right? When all the panels are put in here, so what we'd have is there'll be panels down here that'll integrate over this window. You see the big window there. And then simple technology, window blind, completely blacks out everything. It's great. It's simple. It's easy. It's easy to maintain. That's the kind of thing we want in our aeroplanes. And then eventually here, what you'd see is you'd see the bins coming in. And then up the rear there, just above that galley, is where we'd have some crew rest. So there'll be cabin crew rest up in the crown there. And there'll also be flight crew rest up at the front there as well. Again, very, very making sure that all the systems in this aircraft, some of the functionalities, for instance, have actually been tested in 330 in service, so we understand the operation of these functionalities, and we then put the same functionality, maybe with slightly different equipment, onto the 350. Equally, the 350s are introducing a lot of innovations as well. So it's a mix of innovation and security, because what we want from day one for Qatar Airways and all our operators is that they have reliable aircraft. So we need to build in our reputation for reliability and ensure the 350 will be a reliable and functional aircraft in any fleet from day one. So let's get you onto the flight deck. Frank again is one of our test pilots, and if you get any questions about the 350, he's doing some of the display flying.
Are you flying today?
Yes.
Right.
We're flying every day.
Okay. And ultimately the question is, what's it like to fly?
Yeah.
It's very nice. It's over the years, the way we develop our flight control systems has improved, really. And not only our knowledge, but the way they're designed. And now we can make the aeroplane fly how we wish.
Yeah.
But in fact, the design from the start is very nice as a basic aircraft, and then we just tweak it to fine-tune it, really,
yeah,
to make it exactly where we want.
And what is it like to hand fly?
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's really, really nice. It's very easy. It's very light. The forces on the stick are what you will feel when you go in the cockpit there.
Yeah.
It's because they're sprung, and of course it's a fly-by-wire system, so the signals are sent through to the flight control computers.
Yeah.
And it's the flight control computers that then move the surfaces. Now, what you feel when you're in the cockpit in a minute will be exactly what we feel when we're flying it around the display.
Yeah.
But of course, we have the feedback of the response of the aircraft,
yeah,
as well. So it's very nice. It's very, very nice. In fact, all the aeroplanes, 380s, 400, this one, they all fly very, very nicely.
Okay. And what's your background to get you to
my background?
Test fly in the A350?
I was a fighter pilot in the RAF,
yeah,
test pilot in the RAF. I worked for the Americans on the F-16 development program. I then did a little bit of airline flying on the 330 and the 320, and then I came,
yeah,
to Airbus as a test pilot.
Yeah,
so that's my background in a nutshell. And Pete's the same. We were in the RAF together, actually. We went through test pilot school about the same time.
A Boscombe down.
I went through the French school, and then Pete went through the US school, actually. He went to the States.
Right.
And then we came back together again here at Airbus, and he arrived a few years before me, and he's now the chief pilot, so
okay.
I work for him, effectively.
I suppose you flew the simulator before you flew the real thing.
We designed the cockpit,
yes,
and of course that process started 7 years plus ago.
Yes.
And in the process of designing, there was a lot of simulations and a lot of simulator work. So before the first flight, yes, we did. We did a lot of simulator flying,
yeah,
not only to prepare for the first flight, but also to prepare the design of the cockpit,
yeah,
and do the,
yes,
integration studies.
Chicken and egg, really, isn't it?
What
do you design first, the simulator or the aircraft?
Well, you design the aircraft, but of course you have to have a simulator to make the whole thing come together and work together.
Yeah.
So that's...
Do you use the rudders or anything?
In flight, everything is compensated by the flight control computers, so no. Unless we have an engine failure, in which case we would use the rudders, but generally, apart from keeping us straight on the runway, in flight we don't need to use the rudders.
And is that common across the Airbus aircraft?
Or? Yes.
Okay.
Yes, all the fly-by-wire.
Yeah. Okay.
The other thing, you know, we've done is we've always had this thing called the Iron Bird, and that's to test the systems, and that's actually connected to a simulator, so we can fly it and see the way, from an engineering point of view, see all the way the systems work.
Yeah.
So the first flight of the Iron Bird was about a year before the first flight.
So we connect the simulator to the hydraulic rig, to the electrical load benches. So when we're flying the simulator, we can actually get the flight control surfaces, and it's in a big room, but we get all the spoilers moving, the flaps moving, everything moves as it does on the aircraft, and all the piping for the hydraulic systems are precisely measured to be representative of the first aircraft, so that we get as close as we can to flying the first aircraft in the conditions that we'll fly it in. So that hopefully there are no surprises when we actually go flying for the first time.
We've done that from 320 really onwards, and the 320 one's still going.
We keep an Iron Bird for each aeroplane. And in fact, all the manufacturers do the same thing, the Chinese, the Boeing, Embraer, Bombardier. It's a standard process to make sure the aeroplane is fit to fly for the first flight.
Right, okay.
It's quite a usual thing to do.
Talking about the fly-by-wire system, do you have a battery backup for it?
We have a lot of backup electrical power because we've got numerous generators. Yes. We've got an APU can provide power. We've got a ram air turbine that can provide electrical power. And of course, we have the batteries as well. So there are a number of systems that make sure that we've got electrical power available. And if the fly-by-wire system or the flight control computers fail, we've got a backup mode and the aeroplane flies as a conventional aeroplane. I mean, it's designed as a conventional aeroplane behind the fly-by-wire system. So as a normal... No, the forces are exactly the same. In fact, again, for most pilots flying the aeroplane, they would probably not even notice that they're not flying in the normal flight laws. It really is very, very nice.
What in the cockpit? We're just going to go and have a look. What's been designed into the cockpit to make it more ergonomic for the pilots? Because historically, aircraft were designed for function rather than comfort and duration. What are the sort of aspects that you've managed to design into the cockpit?
Well, there are a multitude of different improvements that we've made over and above the A380. Obviously, with each successive generation of aircraft, we try and move forward. I think probably the most important thing, and the most visually impacting aspect of the A350 cockpit, is the large screen displays. In the A380, we still had the smaller displays. Which were fine, except for things like the electronic flight bag, where you're looking at charts and maps and so forth. Much more difficult to see information and find information. So we knew that we had to improve the interface. We knew that we had this technology available, and it made sense to do it, not only from a human interface perspective, but also from an engineering perspective.
Yeah.
So for reconfiguration and so on and so forth. For maintenance, because it's a single part number screen, we can swap the screens around. It makes it much easier for the operator if we have screen failures. But it also means that we can move information around. We can select information from one screen and we can put it in between the pilots, so when they brief together before the flight for the departure, they're actually looking at the same chart and looking inwards towards each other rather than outwards towards the corners of the cockpit.
Right.
So we wanted to bring the crew together, as we did in the old days with our piece of paper, and they'd say, this is the chart, this is the departure plate, this is what we're going to do. With the old electronic flight bags, it wasn't possible because the electronic flight bags were on the outboard.
Yeah.
And each pilot was looking at his and looking at his, and they weren't really necessarily communicating. It was more difficult anyway.
Yeah.
So with this system, it's much easier.
Right, okay.
And there are a lot of small features that we've added because it's a long distance aeroplane. We've made the seats recline that much further so that, you know, one pilot can at least get a little bit of rest in the seat, which is allowed within the regulation. Whereas if he's upright, it's much more difficult to, you know, it's much more uncomfortable to try and just nod off for a few minutes. We got involved in the design of the flight crew rest. So on the airplane that we sell, there's a corridor here, there's a door here, there's a door here. You go up into, and there are two beds up here. So we were involved in the design of that to make sure it was, you know, it's functional, it was quiet. So for the very long flights, you know, we have reinforced crew with maybe three or four pilots. There'll be two pilots sleeping, two pilots flying, and that way, you know, we can fly the very long trips.
And tell us about the duration of the aircraft then, in terms of its performance.
Well, we're looking in excess of 8,000 miles range, so there's some significantly long flights potentially. Hence the need for crew rest, not only for the flight crew but also for the cabin crew. Probably you might get from London to Darwin, but you probably wouldn't get much further than that. But that's a pretty long flight.
Long
and I think most passengers would rather stop somewhere en route and break the journey up, to be honest. But
it's quite interesting, actually, that the demand now, the technology can take you that far, but actually the passengers
would rather stop. Absolutely. But we're trying to produce a passenger experience which is a little bit similar to the 380, because the 380 has been such a success with our passengers. They like the fact that it's very quiet. They like the fact that the cabin pressure is a lot. The out pressure altitude is a lot lower in flight, much more comfortable for the long flights. So we've done the same with this, and I think all the modern airplanes are going that way. And of course, the engine technology is there to make the airplane more quiet, not only inside but outside. We're moving ahead.
Do you have TV cameras to see where your wheels are when taxiing?
We've got TV cameras to see where the wheels are. Yes. This, funnily enough, this one has not. This is the only one of our prototypes that hasn't got it included.
Does it make any difference to the pilots?
It's really useful because when you hit the button, you can see the nose wheel and you can see the chap is plugged in. So normally on a 320, for example, you haven't got it. And you start the engines and you mustn't forget for him to unplug and disappear, because otherwise if you taxi into him, he's not going to be very pleased. So with this, I can see him, I can see when he unplugs, I can see when he walks away, and I wave him goodbye. And I can also see where the main wheels are. So if I'm on a very tight taxiway and a turn, I can see how close the wheel is going to the grass. Because we have a lot of the airlines in general, one of the things that scares pilots more than anything else is taxiing off onto the grass. And some airports are very tight. So we have a camera specifically for that. Well, one of you sits in that seat, one of you sits in the hot seat.
Oh, okay.
You might as well, I'll take your picture. But as you can see, the biggest... the most obvious thing straight away are the screens and the way that the screens are laid out.
It's just so spacious.
Yeah. So the big thing is we included the screens so that the big screens, for many reasons, it was much better to reconfigure. We can bring the maps and charts to brief, as I mentioned earlier on, into the middle. We can swap. So if the pilot flying, if you imagine you're going into Heathrow and Heathrow suddenly turn around to you and say, your runway's blocked, you've got to go onto another runway. Going onto another runway, you need a second approach chart and a second departure. The guy who's not flying can call them up on his screen, and you can hit the off view offside, that button there, if you want to press it, view offside, that one, yeah. And you've automatically got a copy of his chart, so he can organise the charts for you. All you've got to do is fly the aeroplane, follow the chart. In this case, it's Farnborough taxi chart. But a large scale, you'll see in the UK. And the high ground in red. So it's all colour-coded. So the lower you go, as you descend, colours change. So at high altitude, the UK would be green, green or black. And as you descend, it gradually goes amber and then red as you get down towards the hills. Right. And if you get too close to the hills, it starts to shout at you, you know, terrain ahead. And if you get really close, it says terrain ahead, pull up. And it shouts at you, terrain ahead, pull up.
So, and the head-up display, what information do you get provided with on that? Is that in use?
Well, you've got speed, altitude, heading, flight director, the modes, the flight modes that are enunciated on the primary flight displays. So pretty much everything that you've got on that primary flight display, you've got repeated in the head-up display.
Okay.
And the benefit is that you can take off and land at certain airports with lower minima. So, for example, if you're at Heathrow, our aeroplanes normally take off with 125 metres of visibility minima. With this, you can bring that back to 75 metres if you've got authorisation. For landing, if you're flying to an airfield which doesn't have fancy approach aids to do autoland, and it's got a Cat 1 approach only, then potentially you can reduce the minima, so you can get in worse weather conditions. Each company has to decide whether the routes that they fly and the weather conditions they fly in and the airports they fly in warrant buying this, because it's expensive, it's heavy, and it requires training. So it's a, you know, it's a commercial decision.
So is it standard? Will it be
it's
standard?
It's not standard, no,
right,
it's an option.
Okay. Oh,
it's an
okay.
If you're operating into maybe Alaska or Finland, somewhere where there's a lot of bad weather and fog, and then commercially it may pay. If you're operating just solely into somewhere like Heathrow and Paris, Middle East, it's hard to justify.
Yeah.
It's really hard. But that's the commercial decision that the customer's made.
And the first aircraft we've heard are going to Qatar. How's it performing in hot and high?
It's going well. The guys took the aeroplane to South America, to La Paz. And it worked just fine. We've taken out Aline earlier on this year for the hot weather trials. And nothing really that we weren't expecting in hot weather operations. All the hot and high work has been done. It's all been approved by the authorities. So now it's just a case of finishing off with the functional reliability testing that we need to do. A bit more brake testing, and then we'll be finished at the end of August. So it should be from the end of August. There'll be a lot of paperwork to do with the authorities, and then hopefully we'll have the rubber stamp in late September, I would imagine, by the time they've got the bureaucracy has organised the paperwork.
What's the transition for the pilots coming from Qatar? Are they starting to...
Some of them are already transitioning now, flying at Toulouse in the simulators. We've already flown some of the Qatari pilots. We flew Cathay Pacific the other week. We do quite a lot of work with the airlines, because obviously they're the customers, they know what they want. It's important that we take their feedback early on in the design process. So we have what we call customer focus groups from a very early stage in the design. So maybe 6-7 years ago we started with the customers saying, what do you want in your next generation of aircraft? And as we design the cockpit, we show it to them and say, right, give us your feedback. Do you think this is a good thing? Do you think this is a bad thing? And we collect that feedback on a 6-monthly basis through the design process. 2 minutes, okay.
2 minutes.
And then, you know, we bring the pilots in early. We put them in the simulator to give them simulated, what we call line-orientated testing. And that's part of the requirement for certification to do that.
Yeah.
So, and it has to be, we have to have pilots from all cultures. So Far East, Middle East, US.
Okay.
And we produce a report for the authorities. So that by the time we get to this stage, the pilots that are coming on, that they're going to be trained for this at Qatar, they're now going through the simulator work, the ground school. They'll fly with us on the route proving exercise later this month. And then they'll be ready to fly as soon as they get their aircraft delivered towards the end of the year.
Okay, over to the media centre, and I met Aaron Mehta from Defence News. Okay, I'm in the media centre. I'm with Aaron Mehta, who's the air warfare correspondent for Defence News. Aaron, welcome to Extended.
Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to have you on the show. Hopefully we can talk to you again in the future. But here we are at Farnborough. Some say it's been a very quiet week. What's it been like for you?
I don't know if quiet's the word I would use. The dominating thing at the show from the military perspective has been the F-35. Of course, F-35 was supposed to be at Riyadh. They actually had a whole F-35 preview day just for media on Thursday before the show started. And then a fire broke out on June 23rd that led to a grounding on July 3rd, and that essentially has caused the F-35 to miss the show.
Yeah.
What's been the back and forth here has been that it was unclear until last night that that was actually going to happen. You know, early Tuesday morning, the government said the F-35 could fly with some restrictions. Those restrictions weren't clear. I talked with the Pentagon's acquisition chief around 2 o'clock local time, and he seemed confident they could get a waiver and actually get the planes over for the show. Obviously, a few hours later, the Pentagon decided to ground any hope of that happening.
Yeah. Okay, so what else is here that's been of interest to you? Of course, they've got a mock-up, but it's not quite the same.
They do have the mock-up, and there's some slight... Somebody just joking, it must be an old mock-up, because there's some slight little differences on there from what it looks like now. You know, the from a military perspective for the UK, the question of the maritime surveillance aircraft is very much something that a lot of companies are playing on. Boeing's got the P-8. They also have something called the Maritime Surveillance Aircraft, MSA, making its debut here. Obviously, a lot of people have the idea of taking a Bombardier or King Air and throwing some sensors on it and calling it a surveillance aircraft. So that's another market that's really being pushed at.
We're really missing the Nimrod and its capabilities, and I know it was full of problems, but do some of these aircraft match up to the capabilities that that we'd intended with that aircraft, do you think?
That's my understanding, and the Nimrod was a little before my time, so I never particularly dealt with it. But
I'm a bit older than you.
Well, yeah, I feel a lot older after this week. It's what's interesting is the question of do we want or should the UK go for a large aircraft, something like a P-8, or should it go for a smaller fleet of aircraft that are less capable, but you can buy a lot more of them for the price?
Yeah.
And that's really a decision that I don't get the sense anybody believes has been made yet.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think price will dominate, and I'd love to see some P8s, but I personally just don't see it. I just don't see it happen. Interestingly, though, we've had some incidents in the UK recently that have demanded the resources of a P-8 or that type of aircraft, and we've lacked it. You know, Sea Kings are just not up to that. What about other technologies and aircraft at the museum? What's it attracting for you? And now the F-35 is off the agenda. Where's your time going to be spent?
It's a great question. Part of what we do with these shows is we spend the first few days trying to talk to as many people as possible, pick up what the trends are. And one of the things I'm looking at doing is this mixing of the commercial and military aviation. You're starting to see companies, and Lockheed is a good example, they're expected to make an announcement on their LM-100J today. That's a commercial version of the C-130J cargo plane. And Lockheed hasn't had a commercial plane since the mid-90s. It's just, it's not something they do. They haven't had to do it. And it's no coincidence that as their budgets are drawing down, they're looking for ways to not only find new markets, but to expand the production line and keep the cost down on the C-130J itself.
Yeah. And of course, the Americans are quietly attending. There's not a great show here from the US for obvious reasons, but it's great to have some aircraft here. What about some of the other manufacturers? We've got, of course, got the Italians, we've got the French here as well. Is there anything special that has caught your eye?
You know, it's really interesting. Finmeccanica, for those of you who haven't been to the show, has literally a giant bubble building that stands alone. It's the biggest thing in the air show. And somebody commented to me how quiet they've been here.
Yeah.
So it seems like a lot of people are quietly doing business, not showing off as much, again, as Finmeccanica can be quiet with that giant bubble in the way. The U.S. government is interesting because they have a large number of officials here.
Yeah.
They aren't doing a lot of flights. They aren't doing a lot of very showy things. The idea had been the F-35 would be the star.
Yeah.
With that gone, it's been very quiet. But what I'm told is they're having productive meetings. And people are, 2 years ago, the budgets were really drawn down. There's a lot of uncertainty. People are feeling more comfortable now. And it sounds like there's more business getting done here.
Yeah. There's a lot of delegations from various states here. I've had more invites than I could shake a stick at, to use a term over here, to attend various briefings from I think almost every state in the US. How's that working? Are they all competing against themselves, or is there a cohesive force behind them?
It's really interesting. There's a couple of trade groups. The Aerospace Industries Association is one that's kind of taking the lead for the U.S. And it's a type of thing that I understand, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you wouldn't have seen as much.
Yeah.
And I think there's a real sense, and this ties back to the number of delegates from the U.S. government who are here as well, that if the U.S. is going to continue to compete and dominate the world market the way it has, they need to really make sure that everyone's got the same page. So you're seeing a lot of states have delegations, little booths here, but they're all coordinated in some way.
Right, okay. Okay, I haven't seen the display yet. We're yet to see that. Is there anything special to look out for?
The truth is, I've been in meetings most of the day, so I've been missing around. They had the P8 flew yesterday. That was pretty impressive. You know, a lot of commercial stuff. The Typhoon is incredibly loud. That's really my takeaway from that. Saw an F-18 display, which was really... At one point, it seemed to just stop completely, do 180 degrees, and go the other direction, which is quite impressive. You know, the joke is... If you're Boeing or Eurofighter or Dassault and you're trying to compete with the F-35 with these fourth generation quote planes, your planes are flying. The F-35's not flying here. So I keep waiting for somebody to pop up with a big sign saying, you know, come see the actual flying planes at Farnborough. And they're still impressive pieces of technology.
Yeah. Aaron, thank you very much for joining us today, and hopefully we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you. I'd love to be back.
I'm with Tom Prader-Broom, who's the Managing Director of Parajet.
Hi, good morning.
And we've come along to find out a little bit more about all aspects of the aerospace industry. We want to learn a little bit more about Parajet, but tell us about the sector you're in.
Yeah, well, basically, paramotoring or powered paragliding is a very low-cost form of personal aviation, which is extremely fun. Very simple, something that you can take with you in your car, keep at home without the need of airfields and all these types of things. It works by two main key elements. It's an engine and a propeller, which you wear on your back, and then a paragliding wing, which you then use to take off. So,
You,
for example, in order to take off, you would lie your glider on the floor.
Yep.
You would then put your engine on your back, clip in, step forward with a bit of force. The glider then comes up above your head, and then... bit of acceleration, run forwards, and then take off, and then just sit back into your harness.
It sounds so easy, Tom.
Is it really
that easy?
It really is indeed. I mean, just to put it in some perspective, you can safely learn to fly a paramotor in sort of 10 days to 12 days.
Right, okay. And what sort of entry costs are we talking about to come into this type of the market?
Well, again, very affordable. I mean, in terms of training, that can range anything between sort of £800 and £1,500, depending on the sort of the length and type of the course that you do. Yep. In terms of your equipment, for your machine, glider, helmet, reserve parachute, and your training, you're looking sort of sub £10,000.
Right, okay. So let's talk a little bit about Parajet. Mm-hmm. You're based very close to somewhere that's very close to my heart. You're down in Dorset in the southwest of England.
That's correct, yeah. So we're just sort of we're growing out of it.
Yeah.
So we're taking over slowly one bit at a time.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, we've been down there. The company started in 2001. Gilo founded Parajet.
Yeah.
It all started from Gilo seeing someone flying a paramotor.
Yeah.
Back then they were very sort of basic. And he was so mesmerized by it that he chased after the guy in his car, saw him land, ran over and said, "What's that?"
Yeah.
You know, short time afterwards, he's teaching himself to fly and then started sort of importing a Japanese paramotor manufacturer, which has long since gone out of business.
Yeah.
And after doing that for a short time, thought, "This is crazy. I can do this." Yeah, Gilo's an engineer. He loves engines. He loves everything to do with aviation. And that's where it all started.
Right, okay.
And then following that, the company sort of started to grow. He started to develop his new machines. And what really put Parajet on the map was a TV program in 2007 when Gilo and Bear Grylls flew over Everest. It was called Mission Everest.
Right.
And the concept was that they basically built two very specialised, bespoke, sort of turbocharged rotary engine paramotors, and they flew over Everest with them. Yeah.
So in front of us is what looks like a much more sophisticated piece of equipment than we're used to seeing.
Yeah.
And I saw this and I thought, hang on a sec. This is quite a serious industry now. Tell us a little bit about the product that we can see here.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the old days are gone.
Yep.
Now we're living in the modern era. The materials that are used, the design, design methods and the manufacturing processes they use are all really now cutting edge. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
We're trying to take the designs forward, you know, lead the designs in the industry. The machine that you're looking at the moment is called the Zenith. We released it in 2012, and it was the world's first CNC-manufactured paramotor.
Right, okay.
So all the pieces, the individual pieces, are identical. It's all plug-and-play. The entire machine that you see there, whilst having a cage of sort of 1.4 metres, actually completely disassembles like a Meccano kit and goes into a travel bag.
Right.
So the idea of the machine being you could use it for expeditions, you can take it on holiday, you know, anybody who's got restricted space, and it's very lightweight and very strong.
How much does it weigh?
Depending on the engine type that you use. So you have the frame, you have the chassis and the harness, and then you can use a number of different engines depending on your size and the type of glider that you're using. So anywhere between sort of 22 kilos and 32 kilos.
Right, okay, okay. And let's talk about the performance of this. You know, speed, duration, height.
Yeah, well,
I know nothing.
No, that's absolutely fine. All good questions. They're all subject to variables, depending on the type of glider, the size of the glider, whether the glider's more to be efficient to go cross-country or to be efficient to get lift, whether you're big, small, all these types of things vary. But on average, you have a three-hour fuel tank.
Right.
So you, as you can imagine, you can do a reasonably good distance.
I think 3 hours would probably be enough.
Time for the loo.
And tell me about the aerodynamics of this. You use the term glider a lot.
Yes.
Before I stood on this stand, I would have called it a parachute with an engine on my back.
Yeah.
Does weather affect the performance? Do they have to be particular conditions?
Absolutely. I mean, in essence, it is a parachute, but it's a very advanced type of parachute.
Yeah.
What we call the aspect ratio of the glider, which is the shape and the way that it performs.
Yeah.
Modern gliders are made in such a way that with a paramotor we travel through the air.
Yeah.
And firstly, we want to be able to achieve lift, so we want to be able to go up efficiently. But then once we get there, we also want to be able to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And we have the ability with our modern gliders to adjust the shape of the wing that allows us to transfer the positive energy from the propeller not only into upward movement, also into forward movement.
Okay.
And that's what makes it such a flexible tool, is that you can actually go places. You could fly into wind.
Yeah.
You can go places. In terms of the weather, obviously, it does have some restrictions. You can't fly in very strong winds or rain. Not that you would want to, of course. So it is, but it isn't just a fair weather sport. You know, winter, snow, winter time is some of the best flying you can get, because the air is so smooth, and of course it looks beautiful. There's a lovely bit of a snowy ground below you.
Yeah.
It's just a really, really simple, fantastic sport.
Okay. And what about regulation? What sort of regulations do you have to work under to fly in this sector?
Well, luckily for us, paramotoring has always been very sort of flexible.
Yeah.
It's actually a deregulated sport. It's what we call foot launch, which means if you can carry it on your back, it isn't considered an aircraft in the traditional sense, which means that it's a lot easier to get into, a lot easier to do.
Yeah.
However, as a result of that, the industry is very mindful and very happy about it, the way that things operate. So we self-regulate within the industry. So all schools will teach one of two main syllabuses, which are the BHPA, which is the British Hang Gliding and Paragliding Association, or API, which is the Association of Powered Paragliding Instructors.
Right. Okay.
Both syllabuses will teach pilots everything they need to do to be able to fly safely, understand the weather conditions, and be responsible in the air.
Right.
And as a result, you see very little accidents and problems.
Never heard anything at all. And it seems to me, as an outsider, a very dangerous sport.
Well, no, I mean, quite the opposite. I mean, it appears crazy to people because they see a propeller on your back and they instantly think, James Bond, wow, you guys are lunatics. But actually, the opposite couldn't be more true. Yeah, paramotoring is an adrenaline sport in the sense that you feel energized, and the adrenaline surges through you because you're flying in the air and it feels great. But actually, it's incredibly relaxing. We fight desperately against this extreme sport sort of perception, because a huge number of our customers are guys who love photography, just want to get up in the air, not do anything crazy or advanced, just to buzz around, take in what's below them. Yeah, paramotor flies at very low ground speeds.
Yeah.
A nice summer's day, just go off on an hour and a half long cross-country flight, go and look at some nice sights below you. It's just great fun. So if you're, whether you're 16 or whether you're 85, it really doesn't matter. I mean, one of the guys who's training at the moment is actually 86.
Wow.
And loving every minute of it.
I've got a 24-year-old son
who, once he hears this, I think will be knocking on your door shortly, followed by his dad.
Yeah, I hope so. You should both come down.
Yeah. we're gonna come down and visit you. Where can we find out more about Parajet online?
Yes, well, obviously we have our website, which is www.parajet.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Parajet, and on Twitter.
Wonderful. Tom, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks very much indeed.
Luckily enough, I got the opportunity to meet two of our really great listeners and show supporters, Joe and Paul. Hi, I'm on the flight line now, and I've bumped into two friends of the show. I got Paul Varco and Joe Chung with me. Joe, how are you?
Hello, I'm fine. I'm very fine indeed.
And Paul, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us for a few moments. Start with you, Joe. What have you seen so far today? What are you looking forward to?
Oh, there's so many to actually see here. It's phenomenal. The two aircrafts I certainly want to see the most at the moment, because I'm more of a civvy aircraft enthusiast, the A350, which I'm seeing right in front of me right now, and the 7879, which is just behind us.
Yeah.
It would have been nice to see the F-35 as well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the current news now is that it's not going to come over to the UK. But, you know, safety needs to come first, from what the Americans say, and to be honest, that's true.
Yeah. Okay.
But overall, like I said, there's just so much to see. It's just, you know, it's hard to pick out the real things I really want to.
It's big, isn't it?
It is.
You need a few days here.
It is, and luckily enough for me, I do have a few days, I will be trawling around this place, you know, looking at the most interesting things that I've got here.
Any good pictures yet?
I have taken a few pictures. I haven't taken as much as I wanted to today, to be honest. For me, I'm trying to sort of like go around the stands to try and get this sort of a careers view of things first, and then later on, perhaps if I've got more free time, in fact, I've got other days as well, you know, to really then be more concentrating on some of the photography that I often do.
Right. You lucky boy, you're here for a few days.
Indeed.
And Paul, you're lucky enough to live close by, but you're here to see it in the flesh today. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I've always enjoyed looking at military stuff, but my and probably the favourite thing of mine has been having a good close look at Poseidon.
Yeah.
I saw it at Riyadh and was impressed, but here it really is outstanding.
It does look good, doesn't it? It would be nice to see the Brits buy that, wouldn't it?
If they bought that, I think that would see us well into the 22nd century, to be honest. It's state-of-the-art stuff.
Yeah. And what else have you seen that really interests you, or what else are you looking forward to seeing?
Well, I've had a good look around the show itself inside the chalets. Very interesting places. So I managed to get a quick look in Lockheed Martin chalet as well, which was very nice. Having done all of that now, I'm going to look forward to seeing the air show from the inside. And one thing I'm particularly looking forward to is the Turkish A-129 helicopter.
Right. Yep.
I saw it from the outside yesterday, but I haven't seen it close up, so I'm looking forward to seeing how that does.
And Paul, where can we find you online?
I have a Flickr website, Varx, and I'm also on Twitter at Varx, and you can contact me there.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. And Joe, where can we find you online?
Two places. I have my own little website. It's mostly a careers based. It's www.josephchung.co.uk, and I'm also on Twitter as well, which is where I do a lot of my correspondence to. That's at Joseph Aviation, and you're more than happy to follow and contact me. I was more than happy to at all.
Guys, enjoy the show.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sticking with the Airbus theme, Qatar had an A320 on station, and I had the opportunity to go and talk to the cabin crew and engineering team. I'm on the flight deck of the Qatar A320, and I'm with Ian Moore Fernandez from Qatar Airways. Ian, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's okay. Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. A lovely aircraft, a lovely cabin behind us. Can you tell us a little bit about where this aircraft flies and what services it provides for Qatar?
The A320, the flights, they have a lot of destinations. The short destination, normally it is flying a few. They fly in London as well, but they have a flight with the one aircraft, Airbus 319, but it's business class. It's only business class, 40 seats, only business class. is you see the seats there. Yep. Is everything is business class, but only 40 seats.
Okay.
But the flight are nasty as well.
Yep.
Because the range for the aircraft normally is 5-6 hours.
Right. Okay.
Okay. But the 319, we have one aircraft. They can flow about 7 hours because
right,
they have
okay.
this additional fuel tanks. You know.
Yeah.
But destinations, we flow a lot of destinations. I can't tell you at all.
And what about your role with Qatar? What do you do for Qatar Airways?
Well, I'm doing engineering. The engineering is doing the maintenance for the aircraft.
Yeah.
Okay, we do the maintenance every day. We do the maintenance every day, different maintenance. We have the program to do it,
yeah.
And we have to follow the program. Okay,
right, okay.
And the program is normally we do the daily check every day when the aircraft stops. All we're doing the transit check. It depends the time.
Yeah.
But we have to do one special program, special maintenance every daily.
Yeah.
Is they call it daily check.
Okay.
It's, do we check the levels? The levels, we okay, we do the warning of the craft,
yeah.
And we check for the craft. There's nothing, everything is fine, no
right.
damage, no nothing, no leaks, nothing like that. We check the levels, all
yeah.
levels, oil levels, fuel levels, hydraulic levels, everything. The Airbus, they have a group program. It's,
And what's the aircraft, as an engineer, what's the aircraft like to work on? Is it an easy aircraft to maintain?
Yeah, it's easy.
Yeah.
All aircraft now is very easy. All of them.
Yeah.
Now it's the new technology.
It's made that way.
Yeah, because now you have the special programs, and
yeah.
you have the software, you have the special computers.
Yeah.
And you can check many things there.
Yeah.
And they told you there's something wrong or no.
Yeah.
Okay, I can see something for this outside.
Yeah.
I can see something like
that. Yeah, you can see it if it's broken.
But it's something broken. Yes,
yeah.
it's good. But for
okay.
the computers, we have the program.
Yeah.
We can check the, in the computers. Is something wrong? They told you.
Okay, okay. Well, let's go back and have a look at the cabin of the aircraft.
Okay.
I'm with Sakshi and Penny, and you're flight cabin crew for Qatar Airways.
Yes.
And we're in an A320. Is this the aircraft that you normally work in?
Yes, we are all trained in the 320 family.
Yeah.
And we are also trained in Boeings, but we do work on this a lot.
Right, okay. And we're in, is this business class or first class at the moment?
This is business class.
Right.
12 seats in business class and 120 seats in economy.
Right, okay. And what's the difference between the services? I mean, it obviously looks very different, but in terms of your role, is it a very different service that you have to provide?
Yes. In business class, we... Absolutely. Both the cabins are five-star service, but
yeah.
in business class, it's more personalized service.
Yeah.
Because there are 12 customers, there are like two or three crews operating as the business class crew, and
right.
they give a personalized service, one-on-one service to them.
Okay.
Behind, we do give a five-star service as well.
Right.
But it's
yeah.
it's more
economy
personalized.
Service.
It's no, yeah. it is five-star economy service.
Yeah.
But here it's more personalized.
Yeah.
And here, Penny, my colleague over here, she
yeah.
operates in business class and she can tell, let
yeah.
you know more about it.
Okay, and what sort of things do you have to do on a normal service?
Okay.
What's your job in terms of serving in the cabin here?
Okay. As a business class cabin crew, now I would like to introduce you to our new service,
yeah.
which is New Frontier Service.
Okay.
Which means dine on demand, that you can have your meal at any time that you want.
Right.
Maybe when you come on board, you might get tired, you might want to sleep first and then have your meal later
yeah.
just before landing. We can do that also for
wow.
you.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is the sample of the table setup that we will have on board, that
right.
we will serve
okay.
you on board. Yeah,
okay.
something like that.
And what about the IFE on this aircraft? What IFE does the
IFE? I will let Mr. Vichy, which is the engineer of the IFE,
okay.
talk about it.
Okay.
okay. Mr. Vichy?
Hi, Mr. Vichy. We're just talking about the IFE. What's the IFE services that this aircraft provides?
This aircraft is powered by Thales i5000 IFE system,
yeah.
which allows you to have audio and video on-demand services.
Yeah.
So we have monthly update media services for this one. We have young travelers where we
yeah.
can, for youngsters, we can have like animated
yeah.
movies and serials and cartoons for them.
Yeah.
And we update all the media and your music files. Especially we provide for Apple users. There's an
yeah.
iPod there
yeah.
with which you can view all your music files, your videos,
okay.
your documents directly to the screen.
Right, that's cool.
We have a USB viewer
yeah.
through which you can plug in your USB drive and you can view your pictures
wow.
directly
okay.
to the screen.
Wonderful. Well, it's a lovely aircraft. It's a lovely cabin. Thank you very much for looking after me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're back at Farnborough 2014, and we have JV with us and Tim, of course, and we're just about to get the Pods Challenge, so I'll just play it now.
Hi, Peter, Gareth and Tim, and everybody listening to this episode of Extended. I have a new challenge for everybody this episode, but I'm having great difficulty pronouncing a certain word, so I'm just going to say it the one time and hope to God that it sounds okay. This episode, the challenge is Farnborough related, and I'd like to know, despite the absolutely fantastic flying displays at the air show, which aircraft would you like to add to the list and why? And if you're not going to the air show, if you could go and see one thing, what would it be and why? I can't wait to hear the responses. I'm very glad I finally made it through a tape without crying, laughing, and sort of pronouncing things a bit weird. I froze going, so I'm going now. I can't wait to hear the responses, and I'll see you all in the next episode. Bye, guys.
Okay, so there you go. What would you like to see at the Farnborough Air Show that isn't here? JV, what's
Well, I mean, the answer is obvious. F-35. Well, that's quite of a shame, I must say.
Yeah, it is a shame. How about you, Tim?
I'd say F-35 as well, but also the C series. It'd be nice to see the C series here as well.
I'd like to have seen the C series, and I suppose we would have seen it if it hadn't had the unfortunate incident earlier this year. I just want to see how it compares to some of the other stuff. I'm a bit of an oldie. I've seen F4s here, and I'd love to see an F4 back here screaming up the sky. So for me, I think I'd like to see that. She also asked us there, if we were coming to the show, what would we be looking out for? That's a tricky one. What do you think, Tim?
I'd just be sort of, obviously the air display is good, but go around and have a look inside the halls as well. There's really interesting stuff going on there. The Parajet people, that's like kind of Batman's flying car or something that the James Bond would use. That kind of really wowed me.
Yeah. How about you, JV? What would you like to recommend people come see?
Well, the flying display of the F under them is quite, it's really impressive this year at the show, and we have here at the far end of the runway we have the Vulcan, which we support through our heritage activities.
Yeah, that's a very good shout.
It wasn't at Air Tattoo for some reasons. It's here at the show. We'd be flying starting on Friday.
Yeah,
and I mean, this is unique in the world. This is one of the last seasons it's going to do, so enjoy the flights, guys.
I think that's a good shout.
Definitely. I mean, it will be probably the last time that the Vulcan is here, and have it on Friday for the Futures Day and also the weekend. Brilliant.
Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, well, over to promoting aerospace. Tim, do you have anything that you want to particularly point out before we go?
Okay, my promoting aerospace would be, if you're around, and this is out in time, come along to the Friday Futures Day. It'll tell you all about getting a career in aerospace. All the aerospace companies here are going to have their friendly careers people here and giving you advice and tips on how to get a career in aerospace. Okay. It's going to be good.
Okay, JV?
Same thing for us. I mean, understand here, we have some people from careers, so do not hesitate to come over with your CV, get in discussions with them, check the job offers, and probably apply and get a job with us.
Okay. Don't forget to use our Amazon link for any of those summer purchases. If you're buying T-shirts, go to our show supporters, Basic 6. Of course, they'll give you a 10% discount if you use the promo code EXTENDED. Okay, it's time to wrap up for this episode. We'd again like to thank the Airbus Group for their hospitality today. JB, thank you very much for joining us today. Hope you've enjoyed it.
Sure thing. Thank you very much for coming in. I mean, it was a real pleasure.
Where can we find out about the Airbus Group online? What are all the links?
Well, we are also doing a live blog straight from the show, and we relaunched just right before Farnborough our new website. So you'll find all the info on airbusgroup.com.
Yep. And Twitter?
As well. I mean, all social media are now linked onto the new website. The live account, if you are interested, it's at Airbus Group Live.
Okay. We'd also like to thank White Hart and Peter Dixon for their contributions, and to Doug Worrell and Basic Six for supporting Extended. I'd like to thank Amy for another fantastic Pods Challenge. Do tweet us with your Pods Challenge for Amy, hashtag Pods Challenge. Now we continue on the road next week, and we're going to be at the Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton down in Somerset for the Royal Navy Air Day. If you're going, message or tweet us and we'll meet you. If not, look out for the show in a week's time. Show notes for this episode with the accompanying pictures and links for our topics can be found on our website and our Facebook page. And of course, follow us on Twitter as Aviation Extended. Tim, where can we find you online?
Yeah, well, you can find us online. On the website is www.aerosociety.com, or you can find me on Twitter at RESTimR.
You can find me, Peter Johnson, at NASCOT Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk, as well as facebook.com/xtpmedia. And of course, there in the background is the music, and it's time to say goodbye to Farnborough. Goodbye from JV.
Goodbye, au revoir.
And goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye as well. See you at the next Farnborough.
And remember to stay tuned into this frequency. Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Okay.
Good for me. Yeah. Apart from my helicopter deals.
Sorry. That's put my arms down for a bit.
Right.
Yeah, I got backache. That'll teach me to
was
do that.
Okay?
Hi, Peter, Gareth and Tim and everybody listening to this episode of Extended. I have a new challenge for them this episode, and it's Farnborough... I can't say that word. Hi, Peter, Gareth and Tim and everybody listening to this episode of Extended. Oh my god. I've become hysterical from not being able to pronounce words. Oh my gosh.
This is the typhoon taking off. Is a takeoff. The typhoon.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.